Thank you very much, Steve. Okay, so as you said, I'm Mark Gibson. I work for Schroders Capital in the ILS team there. And I've worked in various guises in the ILS market since the mid-1990s, which is starting to feel like quite a long time. But enough about me. My panelists, I'm very pleased to introduce to you. We're very fortunate to have three very experienced speakers today who are engaged in the ILS market in very different ways. And so I hope that that'll therefore mean we get slightly different answers to the various questions we're going to try to address today. But a brief introduction. So Evelyn Tekken-Summers at the end is the Senior Director and Lead Portfolio Manager for the Insurance Portfolio at PGGM. She has been a long time and major supporter of the ILS market at PGGM, and I sort of categorize her as an end investor in this panel. Kathleen Ferris is the CEO of Artex Capital Solutions, where she's responsible for all business operations and staff. With long and varied experience in ILS, she's focused on providing integrated solutions ranging from fund administration and risk transformation to independent valuation. And Chin Liu, in the middle, is a managing director at Amundi US, and is specifically a director, he was telling me last night, he's got three jobs, of ILS Fixed Income Solutions and Responsible Investment Research. He's been a supporter of the ILS market as an investment manager for many years now as well. So the title of the session is Rebuilding Confidence in Collateralized RE, or Private ILS Markets, and that's what we will try to do. The previous panel, I thought, was very, very well handled. I'll try and do as good a job as John. But it addressed very well the cat bond market, and that has characteristics that make it vitally important, in my opinion, to the ILS market as a whole. And it would be great to see the cat bond market grow and thrive going forward. But the insurance risk market is very, very large and growing, and not everything or everybody can be catered for by the bond market. So this panel will address the world of private ILS, in which collateralized reinsurance in its many forms is the main vehicle that is used to transform insurance risk into an investment. Talking of size, it's hard to say for certain what the size of the private market is, but the clue is in the name, private. But it's safe to say that it's larger than the bond market, and if you force me to try and estimate it, I'd say it's probably anything from 1.5 to 2 times the size of the bond market, something in that area. But size isn't everything, as we all know. The point is that the ILS market is not a niche. It's not a niche market anymore. It's an important component of the reinsurance market, and private ILS is an important part of the ILS market. I will shut up in a minute, but a couple more words before we go to the panel. I'm not going to give a history lesson about the collateralized market, but hopefully that'll come out in this discussion, how it's come to where it is today. But generally speaking, it's grown organically to meet the varied requirements of both protection buyers and sellers, and perhaps because the bond market can seem quite rigid in its operation and access sometimes. There have been bumps along the way, and they shouldn't be ignored or forgotten, and lessons should be learned from them. And I'm sure that this discussion will address some of those, because that's partly why we are in such an interesting market right now. The focus of this panel is forward-looking, and by the way, I will try and leave time for questions at the end. It was nice to see some really good questions on the last panel, so hopefully we will leave some time as well for that. Okay, so start off with a pretty broad question, but along the way there have been different stages, as I said, of the evolution of the private ILS market. And while the bond market has generally operated at the more remote, by which I mean the lower probability level of attachment, the same cannot be said of the private ILS market. So it'd be interesting to hear your views on the role of the private market in the wider reinsurance market, including the extent to which it could provide earnings as well as capital protection. I think that's quite a big topic, so we could dwell on this for a while. And I don't mind, who would like to run with that?
Maybe I can start. Actually, Mark and I cheated. We had this discussion last night. I think in general, the protection comes with the growth of the asset class. We mentioned the cat bond, they grow in a very slow pace, where because of the regulation, because of investors' interest and appetite, it manages the potential risks and then sort of the potential headaches in a more efficient way, versus my observation on the iOS side or on the private side. I think because all of a sudden, let's say, during the period of 2013 to 2017, we had observed a very significant growth of capital running into the space. That's where we observed, you know, the capital moving from previously a more capital protection to an earnings protection layer. But I guess the question is, you know, is this capital appropriate for earnings protection, right? And also, what kind of return target should we assign to this type of capital? And what kind of volatility that should be engaged with this type of capital? You know, they all come together. So, you know, for example, right, if the capital is purely providing protection for, if iOS is providing protection for purely capital protection, then the return target probably should be more or less around the cost of capital for the reinsurers. At the same time, we want to emphasize the volatility also should behave similar, right? Probably in that way, the return would more behave like what we observed in the cat bond space. You know, over the last few years, those were really more earnings events than, you know, a big capital event. But as we mentioned, because capital running into the space a little too fast, we did see a lot of capital, you know, go to the earnings protection where it introduced a lot of noises and a lot of volatility. And I think that's where the challenges we as a market is facing right now, that, you know, some investors did leave the market, I think really driven by some surprises, right? You know, in some double digit losses year after year, probably that's not something they signed up for. So, you know, yeah, I'll stop there. I think it's really just a question about, you know, earnings protection versus capital protection, the return target. And I would yield out very loud, right? Capital come to the market for profit. You know, this is not, you know, a nonprofit, you know, entity, right? Like every investor, we should keep that in mind. You know, they come here, they are seeking long-term profit.
Indeed.
Can I take a big, giant step back? Okay.
Yes.
Because I think it's kind of, I think it's an interesting time in the market to think about how we got to this place, right? I really do think, I think everybody would agree, it feels like a bit of a tipping point or a cycle. It's kind of funny, actually, because in the beginning, everybody was really worried that capital markets coming into the industry was going to take out the cycles altogether. Well, clearly, that hasn't happened, because I think we're in a bit of a cycle or a pivot point. So what I was thinking about is, okay, in 2012, the capital in the space was at about $44 billion. So how did we get from $44 billion in 2012 to $97 at the peak? And of course, it depends on which broker you talk to. I don't know. Maybe we got to $98 at some point. But how did that happen? And I wish I would have had the foresight to ask Steve to put up the broker bar graphs. I think you guys have all seen it. I'm sure it's on Steve's website. You know, where it basically breaks down that $97 billion of capital into sidecars and LWs and cap bonds and collateralized RE. Well, it's very clear if you look at that bar chart where the growth has been. And it's been collateralized RE. So why, right? So I've got a personal story around that. So when I started at TMR in 2007, this was like a real, you know, like we could see that this was going to become something. There were hedge funds that had kind of seen what had happened in the cap bond market. They liked the non-correlating asset. But how do we get at this stuff, right? If we don't want to do a cap bond, what else could we do to get at this risk, essentially, or profit, right? Hopefully profit. So they were coming to us saying, can you transform this in a way that we can digest it? You know, you're taking it in as reinsurance. Can you get it to us, into our fund as a derivative? Well, of course, that's not a very scalable way to do anything, right? And first of all, we didn't really, over time, we didn't really like the fact that we had this mismatch on our balance sheet. So what we kept saying to people later on is, you know, I think if you guys are going to be in this and you're going to do this, I think you need to have a reinsurance vehicle, right? So the next enabler really was transformers. So I know Andre's here today, but, you know, a whole industry came out of some of us saying, look, we will do this, and I think it's interesting for you, but I really think we'd like to face a reinsurance company. So then you saw segregated cell accounts, and you saw transformers, and that actually gave them a really efficient way, a less costly way, and a quicker way to get access to the risk. So now they had options. So you could buy a cat bond, you can get it through a cat bond. I suppose you could still, at that point, we had sidecars. So we started to sort of evolve this concept of getting at the risk. Fronting company, and I think partially as well, another big enabler was brokers and asset managers educating investors around what they were getting, right? So some seeding companies weren't really ready to face collateralized markets directly, so they used a fronting company so they could get at the capital and get more capital, but not actually have to face them directly, and you could see how it all evolves. So the way we got to 97 million or billion is all these enablers. So fronting, fronting companies, TMR and Hanover were a huge enabler because when you get into collateralized RE, you have to deal with reinstatement premiums or reinstatement limits. So now it's not a very efficient use of your capital. So out of that came the ability to provide leverage on a portfolio of reinsurance. So I think it's a really important part of the growth of the market. And I think, you know, I think we have to find a way, you know, to the whole title of the panel, you know, to enable us to have confidence in that market if we're going to see the market continue to grow. So I just thought it was an interesting way to think about the how we got to where we were. It really isn't cat bonds. Cat bonds are a very expensive way to access the risk.
Maybe to add to that, I think actually also the fact that there were not losses in that time period caused the market to grow. It doesn't matter whether it's the cat bond market or the private ILS market. But it seemed for a very long period that ILS was kind of the free lunch because it was diversified. It came with little losses up till then. So yes, the enablers allowed for kind of the plumbing, but ultimately I think if we had losses in that period of time,
right,
it might have looked different.
And I think that it was investors got interested because of the success of the cat bonds and the fact that there weren't losses. And so they were saying, how do we scale this? And so asset managers were clearly saying, we can't really do it with cat bonds, there's not enough of them. So we have to now move into and compete with essentially traditional balance sheets, which is really how the whole thing evolved.
Well, that's an interesting point, Kathleen. And I think that's the heart of the question really is, what is the purpose of ILS capital, and what is ILS capital bringing to the reinsurance industry or the reinsurance market? I think, just being very, very general, you could probably say that in the last, I don't know, year or two, there's a fairly clear trend, in my opinion, that even equity capital supporting reinsurance company balance sheets is not particularly happy with the volatility associated with catastrophes. The original source of cat bonds was really to deal with the top end of people's programs, you know, the capital protection that I mentioned in the beginning of the question. So I think what we've seen is what you've just very nicely said is that the capital came in because capital wanted to come in. The cat bond market probably wasn't big enough to take all of that capital, so by definition, the collateralized reinsurance market emerged. But it clearly has come in and it started to become almost competing with and sitting alongside reinsurance capital much, much closer to the risk. And I'm just, maybe just finish this question once more. Maybe Evelyn, you could just give your view on this. Is that really what you think as an investor you're looking for? Or is it, so, you know, participating alongside that equity capital and taking that relatively higher probability of more volatile performance? Or is it really a sort of a safety valve to provide the capital side?
I think it really depends on who you ask. So I think for me, yes, I think our approach is slightly more remote. So we have a big chunk of cat bonds, but also I think similar amount of size in remote private. But there's also hedge fund investors and private equity investors. And cat bonds will not do. They will not make up for the return. So depending on who you ask,
yes.
The answer is different. I think from a cedent perspective, the fact that there is less credit risk associated with collateralized reinsurance in general makes it, for me, a perfect match for more remote than for the earnings protection.
Yeah. Thank you. Chin, do you have any further comments?
Yeah, I would echo what Evelyn just mentioned, right? I mean, at least from our side, right, we're not hedge fund, right? We don't need that 40% return a year. I think our clients, over long term, they're happy with high single digit or low teens return. So that's really to set the expectation on the return side. But also I think from the healthy of the industry side, right? In the old days, we heard the story that the insurance company did not want their reinsurers to compete with them on their business. So I think in a way, you know, for the long-term healthy of the asset class, right? It's better IOS capital comes in as a complementary to the traditional reinsurance capital versus trying to directly compete, you know, against the capital. You know, first, why there's that need of IOS capital is because we know, generally speaking, cat reinsurance is very capital intensive. The capital charge is very high. That's why the traditional reinsurers don't have that enough capacity to hold those on their balance sheet. So if we come purely compete against around their earnings level, I just don't feel, you know, that would help to grow the market. But however, on the other side, you know, if we come really take their remote side, their tail risk, a true tail, that really helps them to relieve their capital. They can write more business. Maybe that helps the primary market to really, you know, bridge the coverage gap, right? In a way, you know, when the IOS capital comes in, we help to make the entire pie bigger. So I think that might be maybe more healthier over long term for the growth of the asset class versus purely becomes a pure competition about, you know, my market share versus your market share. But, you know, more focusing on, say, how can we be complementary to each other?
And I think that's why I brought that up to begin with, is because, you know, I think it's going to be interesting to see. I mean, you heard the last panel saying that there is a lot of interest from capital. So again, back to this sort of cycle, right? So if we get a lot of capital coming back in and we don't have enough risk or we don't have ways for that capital to get deployed that maybe is considered to be more profitable or the better place for that capital to be deployed, what's going to happen? Is it going to happen again? Do you know what I mean? Where we just sort of, the market just softens again. So I guess that's just a question.
That actually leads quite nicely onto my next question, which is, what do you think, or what does the panel think about being a reasonable return over time? And when we say over time, what do we mean by over time? What's the sort of length of years that an investor thinks about their allocation to this? And
shall I try to answer that first? I think for us, it's more like 15 plus years. So it's really a long-term strategy. Our return target is not ridiculously high. It's mainly in the asset allocation for diversification benefits. So we're funded out of equity. So ideally, we're close to the equity risk premium, but also allows for kind of some credit because it's a diversifier, true diversifier. What I do agree with your statement is we need to be profitable, and that's what we obviously were not in the last 7 years. So it's not for me about a two-year spike in being in part of a hard market, but also kind of sustainable profit long term, because we don't need to forget that we're it's a niche asset class compared to equity, fixed income, but even compared to more private categories such as private equity or infrastructure, it you need to be bold in a way as a pension fund to allocate to this class, where most of your peers do not do that, where there's such a link to climate change, and then to not deliver over quite a long period, that's tough. And I think, therefore, I totally agree with Jin that we should be profitable. And if we are in an elevated phase of climate change, that means that either we should move up again so that we're not bothered with the secondary perils in a way, or alternatively, it should price consistently that we can handle those events and still be profitable in the long term.
Jin, do you have a view on the sort of the level of return?
Yeah, probably similar. We're looking at this on two angles, right? I say, again, capital is here for profit, but then I think the baseline is, okay, what is the cost of capital for reinsure, right? So at least I think the return target should be around that level. You know, essentially, that's how they are paying for their capital anyway, if they're receiving this relief. But internally, from a realized point of view, we're also benchmarking this because of my fixed income background on like some of the high yield or bank loan asset class, right, in terms of spread. In a way, we're viewing this as an alternative for those non-investment grade allocation. You know, to Evelyn's point, this asset class, because of the diversification nature, it does get some credit. So return may not be as high as high yield or bank loan over the full market cycle, but I think it should be close to that level.
So no numbers have appeared yet, but I mean, are we talking about, I think we're talking about maybe the appropriate place for capital to sit in the ILS market is more remote rather than lower down, so it's more capital than earnings. And at the capital side, is there any reasonable expectation for, over time, a more than a single-digit return? Is a more fundamental question.
I think long-term, if you have a horizon of 15 years, and if long-term you're supposed to be close to the equity risk premium, that means that in hard markets you need to deliver definitely more than what you lost in soft markets. Yeah. So it's... I think today we're back to kind of a decent levels of premium.
Yes.
I'm not sure what
7-8% like high yield,
right,
type of,
yeah,
long term, you know, return, right? Or equity, again, if you look at the last 15 years, probably it's higher, but over long term, you know, again,
yeah,
around 8%, right? But again, acknowledging we do have the potential, right, let's say every year could be that 100 years.
Yes, yeah, indeed.
Right.
But
so,
it has been a while under that level,
right,
for quite substantially, actually. It was maybe more closer to 3. So in order to be long time close to the equity risk premium or to the high yield risk premium,
yeah,
then you definitely need some decent years.
Yeah, you need to build some cushion there.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we that's very helpful, thank you. Okay, so just talking about pricing then, and maybe other things about collateralized reinsurance. So the January 1 renewal period, which for those of you in the room, probably not many, may not be familiar with the market. The January 1 is a very important time because a substantial proportion of the available investments are traded at that time and incept at the 1st of January. And that period that we've just passed through saw very substantial changes in premium levels, but also in structures, in attachment levels and other terms and conditions. And collectively, these have rendered the private ILS market to be a materially more attractive market than certainly the previous couple of years into which to allocate capital. So please, can we discuss in some depth what these changes are? What are the important changes from your perspectives? So not just price. We've been talking about returns just now, but what else is good about collateralized reinsurance in terms of enabling structures to change and coverages to change?
You want to take it?
Sure. I think we're seeing the evolution, right? Clearly, this year was a very, very hard market. probably, you know, one of the hardest over the last decade or, you know, if not even longer. See, ever since 2020, right, I mean, the industry was surprised by COVID. I think after that, you know, we are seeing on the retro side, particularly named peril versus before that was like all risk. And then I made a joke, say in 2020, despite the industry was doing named peril, those named peril were five pages long. You know, I need to check my dictionary about some of the definition, right? Versus at least this year, particularly for those remote layers, right? It's wind and quake, that's it, right? You can have everything written in one line. So I think there's a for sure much narrow definition of risk coverage. I think there's also a very clean definition of territory scope. You know, before we oftentimes see worldwide, but now it's very well-defined territory. And then again, before many cities were trying to put property, aviation, marine, you name it, energy into one transaction, right? I don't think those transactions got much attention this year. So, you know, all those behavior or those changes may not be 100% reflected purely on pricing, but I think those really help to narrow or to avoid the surprises. I think, you know, part of the reason capital left the space or investors are reluctant right now, not because, you know, we were facing large surprises, right? I think probably there had been a lot of discussion, where really we were facing a lot of sort of unexplainable secondary peril, you know, COVID, Texas windstorm, yeah. You know, sort of all kinds of a wildfire. Those are not something investors were signed up for. You know, when they received the education about iOS, it was all about wind and quake. So I think at least, you know, with the cleanup of the contract language going forward for those more remote layers, we're not going to see those surprises. It's very well defined. You know, clearly, you know, the retention has been increased. You know, we are seeing aggregate transactions become significantly more difficult to place, or some citizens choose not to place those. You know, in the end, right, say aggregate transactions are essentially a product of soft market to begin with. So, you know, I'm glad to see you know, the movement you know, on that direction as well.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's that covers it. Personally, I'm mostly excited about the silent cover, so the silent cyber terror and pandemic to be removed. I think that's very difficult to explain to a board. Well, they expect to be in property cat.
Yes, I think you had a phrase. You're even more direct when we're talking about this. You just don't want to see any stupid losses. You just don't want to have to sort of
that would be great.
Deal with these conversations.
I'll sign up for no stupid losses.
Smart losses.
Yeah.
No, but it's not a problem if you need to report on losses and you need to explain losses.
That earthquake, right.
Indeed,
right.
That's exactly what you explained to your board. That the asset class will be all about, but it is so complex. And you typically you also do not spend a lot of time about the risk transfer because that's so complex. So high over, they know what the asset class is all about, and then they be surprised by COVID. That's totally different ballgame.
Yeah,
I guess again going back to kind of what can we learn here, we just have to really maintain that discipline. Right? So, you know, like what is going to enable us to stay, you know, at a pricing level and terms and conditions that truly are sustainable? You know, because we all know, right? So if the capital starts to come in, the brokers are going to get aggressive, there's going to be people that, you know, maybe this is about alignment. I don't know. Maybe we need to really take a step back. You know, and I'm not an asset manager, nor have I ever been, but maybe we need to rethink how we're taking in capital and also then on what basis we're deploying it and not be quite so aggressive this time around. I don't know.
That would be great, but I don't count on it.
Right,
because,
me neither.
These companies all are being paid for their AUM. So I think ultimately it's us, the end investor, that can really decide to well, discontinue or decrease allocation if we are going back to a similar market.
Is there a new model, though, Evelyn? Is there something, you know, like, is there, again, because whenever there's this kind of dislocation, I mean, that's what's great about it, frankly, is people sort of wake up and they start to think of maybe a different way of doing things, right, that might be more sustainable. So have you had any of those conversations with asset managers around, actually, maybe we aren't quite as aligned as I'd like to be? Or maybe you can't disclose that, but
I don't know. Yeah. No is the answer. I think it's hard to solve for. But therefore, I think truly the end investor is the one that should
dictate.
Right. And well, not dictate, but determine if you're not happy with those terms, then you should reduce the allocation or
right.
get out of it.
Right.
I think it's hard for a manager who's dependent on AUM to make that decision
right.
for you because you're just not aligned at that point.
And maybe this just is longevity, right? Maybe now we have enough of investors that have been in it long enough that know enough that will then push for what is a more sustainable market. I don't know. Let's hope, right? Because that's what we need. We need it for the industry. It's not really just for capital markets. We need it for reinsurance, right? So it's kind of like I think people now in this market have realized, you know, what's a saying? You don't really appreciate something until you don't have it anymore. You know, that the capital could go. It, you know, it could just decide we're not in this anymore. So I do think we have to continue to be innovative, continue to be trying to reflect back on what didn't work, what did work, and how we can build a more sustainable market. That's my hope.
Yeah.
I don't have any of the answers, though, Mark, sorry.
No, but well, one of the things I think mechanically, which we haven't touched on, I think it was touched on in the cat bond session, was the management of collateral. And I'm wondering if you have any views about, maybe from your own point of view, Kathleen, at Artex, this is something you probably see, some of the mechanics of collateralized re changing. So have there been any material changes in the way that people are having to pay for extending or not handing money back, and you know, what are those structural changes?
I mean, I think there has been obviously more discussion about it. We're learning, you know, again, this is the market maturing, and we're learning what's working, what's not working. But I take kind of a more holistic view around what could really have an impact. I think what the problem that we have is an industry problem. The industry problem is data and transparency of data. I mean, I think If we're going to have a conversation around should we release the capital, can we release the collateral, it's really about the losses and the data. So what's exciting for me is, again, seeing, and this is where I love the place that we sit, because you know, we're sort of in the middle of everything, and we can see startups that are thinking innovatively around data. We can see what's happening on the cyber side. So you sort of get a sense of what some of these trends are that could have a real significant impact, and data is critical, right? So what we really need is we need access to real-time front-end data. You know, we're way at the other end of the value chain. So, but we really need to be able to, all of us, whoever's in a transaction, be looking at the data on a real-time basis around losses, loss development, so we can have a real conversation around, is it adequate? What are the trends? How is this trending versus, you know, the other loss that we had, you know, 6 months ago or a year ago? So I think data and data insights and having the ability to get access to that data is going to be what will change that conversation. And so I probably won't see it, but there's a lot of very young people in the room that, you know, this is what needs to happen to really have an impact. You know, we can work on collateral release tables and, you know, we can have those conversations, but honestly, until everybody has that one version of the truth that we can all come to the table and analyze and talk about and get comfortable with, I don't really think much is going to change. That's just kind of my view.
You're working for the solution for the next generation.
Yes.
I'm more worried about what are we going to do for end of this year, right? I think on our side, in the end, money talks. So for the short term, you know, we're trying to really push for more financial incentive, right? Yeah. Which is baked in at the inception of the contract,
yeah.
right? Because sometimes I'm joking, say, I'm just tired of calling broker, calling Satan and say, please sign that piece of paper.
Right.
You're not going to be killed, or that's not a death sentence, right? Almost feel like, you know, why is it so difficult to get a signature back? Because I think two things, right? Traditionally, for the traditional market, it's a rated paper. So there's no urgency of,
right.
you know, value of time, right.
right?
So most of the buyers, most of the Satans that don't really feel, oh my God, 5 days really means something, you know, that's the least priority on their, you know, 55 things
right.
they have to do during those very busy renewal time, right? So, but then on the other side, right, it's like, if I have no cost, so what, right?
Right,
I mean,
exactly.
Come tomorrow,
yep.
right? So what we're trying to do is really say, okay, you know what, right? We'll give you a reasonable 5 days to sign. If not, right, we'll bake terms and contracts, say, delayed signature
right.
will charge you, you know, additional premium or interest, right? In a way, sometimes I'm jealous of the cap bond space where you'd never have to worry about those signatures. There's extension spread, right? So there's financial incentive, there's significant reputational damage. Imagine if a cap bond is default because someone forgot to sign the release letter, you know, the person gonna be fired, right? The bad reputation out there. But there's no consequence
That's
in
right.
our space.
Yeah. And we did see some of that this year, but not as much as I would have expected. So I think it must have been a difficult conversation.
Yeah.
And you guys will know, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough, right? But I think in the end, you just have to remind them, say, you know what, right? The relationship goes both ways, right?
Right.
Like, you need our money to be in the trust on day one. We're trying to do our best, but we need our money to be out of the trust, you know,
in a reasonable
yeah. 5 days after the risk period end, right? And I think in the end is really the education, say, you know, there's a value associated with the time, right? So I think that helps, but also, you know, clearly with a long-term relationship, right? Like, you know, another improvement we're seeing, particularly on the proportional side, the loss buffer table have improved dramatically compared with, I would say, 5, 6, 7 years ago,
right?
Right? I mean, I remember when we did our first quote share more than a decade ago, right? It was like 200 or 250% of, you know, buffer table. But now usually that is shrink to,
yeah.
you know, 10, 25% as the assumption you continue the relationship, right? So we do see also students, they get more comfortable as time going on. They realize it's 100% unnecessary to be that punitive just for the sake of feel safe.
Yeah.
Yeah, I fully agree. And maybe to add to that is if you stay into a long-term relationship, then typically what we experience is that we can roll over at reserve so that there's actually not even a buffer table applied.
Right.
So I think there's definitely good trends. Also, I like the fact that there was actually more commutation on old risk if it was loss-free instead of keeping it open. I think that's also very helpful for us. Getting more balanced, so that's good.
Yeah, and I think this renewal, there was an incentive to do that, right?
Yeah.
Because they needed the capacity. So again, you know, I think all that is fantastic, and hopefully we can keep those kinds of terms in. I guess it's really the brokers that are going to drive a lot of this, but
or certain
education, because it's important. Yeah,
right. Because sometimes I'm like, why do you need the approval of that signature from your CEO? By releasing something that is way below your attachment. And by the way, during the renewal period, you assured us 5 times this transaction is totally loss-free. You should not penalize us by increasing the rate.
But that's because right. they aren't really analyzing their own data in a way that gets them comfortable with that. That's why I say.
Or authority.
I'm going to draw that particular topic to a close.
Okay.
Steve hasn't started waving his arms at me yet, but we are not getting through our questions panel.
Wow.
There's clearly so much to talk about. But I think just to summarize that topic, I think it is not just price, but there are definitely structural changes which are improving the picture, and so move on from that. But thank you for the content. So I think we have to try and be selective here. Let's go on to something which was talked about a little bit in the cat bond session, which was moving beyond a natural catastrophe risk and thinking about whether there's a role for the collateralized reinsurance or private reinsurance market to get involved in other perils other than nat cat. So, you know, who would like to go with that one?
Are you guys doing anything beyond NatCat?
No. Maybe you can start then.
I think just...
Well, actually, I'd like to just maybe go back to Evelyn. So what is it that would make... Well, what is it either makes you say no because we're not interested in that, or what would make you say, yes, we are interested? What is it that would drive that?
Well, it's partially our board, because I do see some benefits of having different perils in ILS. But our board believes that ILS itself is more complex to other categories. They feel that after 17 years, they kind of understand the property cat part of it. And I think also the cyber and the terror are not very helpful. So, and then we have plans of and tons of mortality and longevity risk mainly. So I think there's questions about a lot of category or a lot of business lines. And on top of that, we always are worried about how sizable is it. So what's going to, is it going to have an impact on our overall portfolio? And I think for now, the ball dropped the other side, so we decided to not. But I definitely see cyber as such a big capital, a big charge of capital that it allows for being part of ILS, definitely.
Right.
Yeah, I think probably this goes back to our early discussion, right? How can we be complementary, right? So that's, I feel like, you know, for ILS capital, it better serves those very capital intensive lines of business, you know, like, yeah, you know, NatCat or potentially in the future cyber if we get comfortable. But then for other lines, right, like, you know, casualty, where we know you rely significantly on the investment of the flow, where you cannot do that on ILS. So you're at a very natural disadvantage by, you know, investing in casualty. That's just our view. But then, you know, within the sort of capital intensive lines, right, similar to your situation, Evelyn, we're only doing NatCat. We're watching cyber very, very closely. You know, we do acknowledge the growth, the need for, you know, capital for capacity, but I guess we're just still uncomfortable regarding the modeling, the pricing,
the definition,
you know, the legal system, you know, the court results, and ultimately also the correlation, right? I mean, for NatCat, at least we get the comfortness a Florida hurricane gonna have nothing to do with Calquake or, you know, Europe or Japan. It is still a localized event, but we're not able to get over the concern in a real bad situation. Cyber could be totally correlated with each other. Then your entire book could be blown up by a very, very big event.
And would you consider doing it on a pro rata basis, or would you do it on an excess of loss basis?
Probably if we were starting, I'd rather do it on a pro rata basis, right? So yeah, get more information there.
Yeah.
But also to get us more comfortable, I think we'd rather do it on a more narrow defined peril, right? For example, just deal with, you know, cloud malfunction for a few hours versus a very, very broad kitchen sink of cyber risk, you know, in a portfolio.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Kathleen?
I guess I would say that I think the last 12 months, actually, it's in my mind, we definitely are seeing the conversation and the discussion now move to something that's can be executed on, right? Because we've always had this conversation around how do we bring in casualty? How do we bring in specialty? How do we grow the market? And so really, honestly, just in the last 12 months, I've seen where, and we've seen, again, sitting sort of in the middle of all this, that that we're now moving to a place where I think those things will start to happen. And we are seeing that happen. And I think that's really important for the market. If we do want to grow the market, we have to have more risk coming in, clearly. And again, to Evelyn's point earlier, you know, it's not going to be for everybody. It's going to be depending on what your risk appetite is, what your return profile is. But the bottom line is that if we're going to grow it, we have to have more risk coming in. So cyber definitely, you know, I think it's interesting what Lloyd's is doing currently, and they're being extremely intentional around trying to open up a way for alternative capital, third-party capital to come into, you know, easier into syndicates. You know, it's an evolution, but it's coming, and they're having the conversation, and the PRA is involved, and the treasurer is involved. So, you know, I think that's an interesting space to watch. And again, it takes time, right? I mean, takes time, and we've seen that with what's happened with even with Property Cat. Yep. So, and I think the casualty space is interesting. I like the idea or the concept that the people that are trying to bring casualty to the market, you know, are leveraging technology. They're trying to, again, find a new way to package things and give people the transparency and the data that they need to get comfortable with that. So it really is an interesting time. It really is. Yeah.
So I think I'd like to throw it open to the floor. I mean, we've got more topics we can talk about, clearly, but and we can talk about some of these topics for a long time. But yeah, there's a microphone needed over there, please. Can we have a microphone over for this question over here, please? Just in the front.
Evelyn, I totally agree with you that for those of us that are multi-asset allocator investors, there's responsibility on our plate for deciding where to allocate capital. And if rate on line goes too low, we should be willing and able to totally step away from a space. Yep. Right? In the same way that if high yield spreads get too tight in bond land, don't invest there. That said, other parts of the asset management industry, you know, private equity, high-quality private equity funds get oversubscribed. Do pro rata allocations to investors. High quality hedge funds close their funds, they have a good year, they return capital to shareholders. Even small cap equity mutual funds in America will close their funds at a certain point in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Is there no responsibility in the asset management industry and reinsurance to be thoughtful about, you know, we have so much capital, we're starting to move markets, we should close, we should return capital to shareholders?
Hopefully, yes. But experiencing basically between 2010 and 2018, we didn't see it. We didn't see it at large scale. So I think a lot of funds did allow for large inflows. So therefore, it's easier to determine yourself whether you think it's at a tipping point where you should step out or not. But long term, do I believe it's sustainable for ILS managers to also put a hard stop in it? I think it's good for their reputation as well. So ideally, yes, and everyone learned their lessons. But I'm not 100% sure that will happen. What do you believe?
It's public, right? We soft-closed our product in March of 2018. Because end of 17, sort of November, everybody was trying to celebrate the wonderful rate environment they were hoping for.
Yeah.
It did not achieve. It was very painful. We had to go back to our investors telling them, sorry, we're not gonna take your money, right? That's some very long-term relationship. We get yelled at and get threatened to say, okay, if you don't take our money, we're gonna go to your competition, we're gonna go somewhere else, right? So it's beyond my pay grade, right? Then the conversation with the investor is very, very challenging because they do hear in the market, they want to put the money to work, right? So unless everybody maintain that discipline, you know, the money may not come to you, may go to another manager who just deploys, right?
Yeah.
But I think I agree with you, that did buy us very good reputation in front of the investor, right? To show that record that we were willing to, you know, close our product. But it was very tough decision.
Okay. Okay, a couple more questions in the middle here.
Hi, Crystal Liu from Gilson Capital. My question is just around what would it take for capital to flow in, you think, at this point, and how long do you think that will take? And then also, what do you see on outflows currently to go, like trapped capital that still you think is trying to leave the collateralized RE market? Thanks.
So what would it take to see flows is the first part of the question.
Well, my expectation would be a couple of close to no losses. I think that would be very helpful in order to for pension funds to regain trust that actually there is no, or there exists climate change, but not maybe to the extent that we experienced over the last couple of years. Yeah, that would be my answer. And I think on the other question, I personally believe there's still a trap collateral indeed as part of AUM, but I'm not aware to the extent.
Right.
Yeah, I would say probably you do need at least like a one good year, right, to demonstrate to end investors there is value in a sector. We do have observed, you know, more discussions. Investors are paying attention to the asset class, but you know, until that sort of one good year, they're not going to move their needle dramatically.
Another question here. How much time do we have, by the way, Steve? Five minutes.
So there are a couple of things that Evelyn, you and Jin, you mentioned that I thought I would ask about. Jin, you mentioned about growing the pie, and Evelyn, you mentioned about named perils and keeping the stupid loss out. My question is, how do we actually, what else can we do to grow the pie while maintaining the discipline that we have? What other things we can do throughout the value chain of insurance and reinsurance to grow the pie, still deliver the return that our investors expect, and achieve the noble goal of providing the resiliency and protection that our insured deserve?
You want to start?
Sure. In the end, right, for the entire value chain to grow the pie, it's really from the very, very beginning, from the insurance side. Funny enough, I had a discussion yesterday, right? You know, I think we know in the cat bond space, the brokers motivate a bunch of corporate buyers to come to the market to buy some earthquake cover, right? I think there's still significant insurance gap, you know, especially outside of the US. Even in the US, we know California, the earthquake take-up rate is still very low, right? So I think, unfortunately, right, that's not something we can achieve overnight. You know, we can achieve this year, but I think over long term, you know, if we are able to show the benefit, right, those corporate buyers or those solvent buyers come with more parametric transactions, and they do need very large limit. And you know, that's not something like one insurer or one insurer can take, right? That I think fits the capital market appetite very well.
Yeah. Maybe to add to that, from an investor perspective, I would say transparency can still improve. And I think also costs are really important, that it should be, ultimately you look at your net returns, and if returns fall below a certain amount, then costs become relatively large. So I think, while growing the pie, hopefully the asset class becomes more mainstream, and with that, transparency increases and in cost reduces.
Oh, one more here. I was just going to, in the front row here, please.
Hi, Minas Kalashin with Vestu. Actually, you beat me to the question. I had a similar thought about that, actually, you know, growing the pie. Where does the factor of, you know, pricing the risk properly, I think you alluded to, right, goes to the chain, how does that come into play, and how do you think about it, right? So it's not a matter of, do I want it, you know, I don't want it. We fully agree that it has to be very kind of prescribed. Investors have to know what they're getting into, no surprises. But how are we thinking about, you know, being able to price the risk properly and charge for it, and that way growing the pie as well, and also giving, you know, giving investors maybe a broader kind of exposure to the asset class?
I think a few thoughts there, right? First, probably not to hammer cyber, which I feel we're uncomfortable with the modeling there, because we argue the process may not be stationary. You know, you're seeing, you know, more changes. At least on the NatCat side, right, at least, you know, say some parallel like earthquake, I think we have a general confidence where it is a stationary process. You know, even for something like hurricane, you know, despite the concern around global warming, climate change, that's not something that may happen next 12 months, right? So I think there's, in a way, there's decent confidence in the modeling process where based on not enough history, based on not enough, solid enough scientific research, there's that sort of assurance. And also it comes to the mind where I think either insurance or reinsurance, right, the capital is helped to mitigate the volatility, but not the trend, right? I mean, so that means, you know, if we're seeing the trend going up, we need to adjust that very quickly, which, you know, a witness is the California wildfire, right? Like ever since 17 and 18, you do see the industry dramatically adjust the risk view. So I think it goes both ways, right? It's really your understanding of the modeling process, you know, the information behind it, and really to make sure, you know, to your way, like get the correct pricing. But the other thing to make in mind, probably that's one thing people don't talk a lot about, is in a way, reinsurance itself is a cyclical business to begin with, right? So, you know, the pricing is not just purely, you know, whether you price your risk properly. It's really how much profit margin, you know, we think we need to add on, right? It's like, you know, compared with last year, do we believe risk is really up 40%? No, it's because capital providers are demanding much higher return, right? So we also have to incorporate that regarding the, you know, cyclicality of the business itself. So that's probably outside of purely, you know, risk pricing.
Wind up. Okay, well, I got the signal. Thank you very much. So thank you very much to my panel, Evelyn, Kathleen, and Chin. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Thank you.